A stranger with a gun came upon two teens taking pictures under a rising full moon. But violence is only the beginning of this story.
Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and I've spent my career talking about how lives are undone by violence. The Letter is a podcast about how lives are remade. Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Today on First Lady and Friends, our conversation was with Liz Owens. She is the CEO at YWCA Utah. She has an incredible story of growing up in Utah County here in Utah and also spending time with her education in the UK, learning incredible lessons on empowering women and dignity for all. I hope you have fun like I did, and let's get proximate. We are here with First Lady and Friends, and my friend today is Liz Owens. She is the CEO of YWCA Utah. Liz is a womanist. I haven't heard that word, which I love. A womanist, a feminist, multiracial, multicultural woman of color from Utah. She serves as a community educator, gender justice, and racial justice activist. Her multi-issue work is firmly rooted within a human rights and social justice framework with a focus on the intersections of power and privilege. That is a lot.
It is.
And I am so happy you're here.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we met, gosh, it's been about a year ago, a little over a year ago. We decided to do a service project at YWCA, and you were amazing, and you were just getting started.
Yeah.
Which was crazy.
Yeah, I'm coming up on my second year anniversary, but it was the second week of the lockdown when I started, so it sort of feels like either 10 years some days, and some days it's like 2 days.
So. Yeah, I can see that. But let's go, before we get into all that and your work here, you just have an incredible story, and I just want to hear it. I want our listeners to hear it. I want to talk about, you grew up here in Utah, in Utah County, and let's talk a little bit about that, your family background, and just kind of what that was like.
Yeah, so I grew up in Provo, Utah, went to Timpview High School, go Thunderbirds, and loved it, actually. So, I mean, it was a unique experience because I was, you know, especially in the 80s and the 90s, it was a predominantly white community. And growing up as a person of color, that was always kind of like the identifying thing about me and my family. But we were really involved in our church and our community. And I just felt like, you know, people often ask me, like, how did that feel? And I feel like I had a really great childhood and continue to have a really great connection to my years growing up, including through high school. Like, I enjoyed high school. So there were some challenges, and some of those challenges, I think, really started to lead me to my career path, which made me think, and primarily it was the things that pointed me out as different, as both a young girl and a young girl of color, and those became really salient in my life. Just trying to understand it, because oftentimes it was pointed out to me, and trying to find my place in the world, as all kids are. And I just continue to follow that. And so my whole career has been really focused on women and issues impacting women, particularly women who have additional barriers to accessing safety and security and economic empowerment. So that all started in Provo, Utah, and just looking through life, or looking through at my life through really a lens of how do I fit in here, and what's my role, and what makes me different, and why are some people pointing it out, and what does that mean to me, and that sort of asking those questions and trying to understand my life. And for me, it was actually, although there were some hard times, it was a really positive experience, and I feel really grateful because I had a great childhood, and I loved Provo.
Oh, good. I'm happy to hear that. Yeah. Tell me a little bit about your family of origin. Did you, did you have other people of color that were part of your family, part of your neighborhood? How did that all play out?
Yeah. So my mom is from Samoa. And she is, and she was raised LDS, and she went to BYU Hawaii, and she, this is kind of a typical kind of BYU Hawaii love story in some ways. So she was on scholarship there, and she worked for the Polynesian Cultural Center, mm-hmm. and she met my dad, who was stationed there. He was in the military, and he's Black.
Oh, okay.
So, she had three kids, got married, had three kids, and then when they got divorced, she decided to move to Utah because we have family here. Mm-hmm. Obviously there are a lot of Polynesians who resettle here, and so she thought that this would be a great place and we'd be close to the church that she was raised in and some family members. I think what was different about my experience is that I don't speak Samoan, and she didn't raise us to speak Samoan. We just didn't have any, by the time we moved here, I was five, and we didn't really have any close connections to the culture besides her.
Okay.
And a lot of the kids here did. They were raised either in the islands and moved over, or they were raised speaking the language, and we weren't. And so we, being my two older brothers and myself, and so we had a lot of cousins and friends, but I think, you know, there was also some wards and some, there's a few LDS wards and branches that are culturally specific. And so we've always been close to the Samoan wards and that sort of thing. So there was always a community of folks. But I never felt, I mean, even now in the Samoan wards, sometimes they speak Samoan. And my mom will, or my family will be speaking Samoan. And my mom will say, well, what do you think, Liz? And I'm like, I don't understand or speak Samoan. So she just forgets that she's going back and forth through the languages. And so there wasn't really like a clear fit. And in high school, there was a lot of Polynesian kids who hung out together, and they were friendly, but they were, I was not necessarily part of their group. And I think the same is true for my brothers. And I have received some comments from Polynesian folks where they were like, oh, it's so cool that you're Black. And so I could see that they clearly saw me as Black as opposed to
Samoan, okay.
like them. So I never felt totally like that was my group either. But just made a group of friends who I'm still friends with. So,
which is amazing.
Yeah.
Well, that's an interesting thought too, because we were just honoring an artist at these Mansion Awards, Artist Awards, and his name is Fidelis Bueller, and he is, his mom was from the Gilbert Islands, and his dad was European and American. And it was like, he talks about this dual cultural identity. So that's kind of what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. And that in a lot of ways, I've heard that described as, it's really hard to know where your identity is, because mm-hmm. Samoans don't see you as Samoan. Black African American people don't see you as African American because you're Samoan. So describe a little bit about sort of that identity piece that kind of you have to wade through.
Yeah, I mean, that part of that experience of growing up and figuring out who I am was, that's a really good way to explain it, is that I didn't really know where I fit. And there seemed to be so many people around me who kind of fit naturally in places. And I never did. And it was often pointed out to me, just whether it was the way that I looked or having the unique experience of having been an Army brat for a short period of time. But I wasn't born here, and all my friends were. So there was always things that sort of set me apart. And I think, especially when you're young, you're looking for where you belong. And I think I held space for that, as well as just, I think I was lucky because I felt like I belonged in a lot of different ways. But what interested me are the ways that I didn't feel like I belonged in my own community. Because in Provo, funny enough, I got asked more where I was from than when I lived in London, where no one asked me. But then I'd come home to visit, and I'd, you know, there'd be someone in the store or whatever, and they'd say, where are you from? And that always is like a reminder to me, like, from Provo, like, this is where.
Why are you asking?
Yeah. But I think that is my story in coming to terms with like my identity, and that, because that was so salient, it really led what I was interested in. It really provided the foundation for my career in thinking about how different identities interact in society and what it means to be a woman or a girl and a poor woman or a girl or a wealthy woman or a girl, because those are different experiences. And the experience of being a woman and a girl is different based on your other identities. And that all became really interesting to me. So I think I just continually watched it. But growing up, I didn't understand it. I mean, there were definitely times where things would happen or people would say things to me, and I thought it was about me. And I that became part of my story. And then when I went to college and I was able to learn other frameworks for understanding the world, patterns of the way in which women experience the world, like commonalities of shared experiences of women, of people of color, and I could see myself in that, I was like, wait a second, all of those things that I thought were about me personally were actually shared experiences that other women or girls or people of color have. And then that even felt more of like a epiphany and a comfort, and I think it continued to pique my curiosity about the different ways in which people experience the world. And then what really would get my fire going is I've been really fortunate, I feel like, my entire life in so many different ways. Just had a lot of love and support around me, and the ways in which other people didn't have that really made me want to do something about that. So that's all that just led me to thinking about women with lack of access. And I built my career around that.
That's incredible. And I love that. And I love that you sort of channeled that into something that you wanted to know more about. I love the curiosity of that. That's kind of my new thing lately, is just being curious about everything and just not, you know, not limiting yourself to what you can be curious about, what you can learn about. Mm-hmm. I think that's really cool. So tell me, so you went to TempView, and then these experiences started to resonate with you and led you to where?
Well, I started at Utah Valley University, and actually I didn't know what I was gonna, I was like a lot of people, and I had no clue what to major in. And, I was first generation as well and didn't have a lot of, I mean, I had a lot of support for attending, just not a lot of experienced guidance on how I should plan my future or my career. And so besides like academic advisors who, were helpful, didn't really fill the full gap of help that I needed to focus. And I had a lot of friends, parents who had gone to college who were trying to help me. But some of the things that they had presented to me felt so out of my reach. For example, one of my friend's dad said, "Oh, you should go to law school." And I was like, I've never met a lawyer yet at that point, you know, like it just seems so, I didn't know anybody who went to law school. And so, so that seems so out of my reach. And so I just kind of tried to figure it out. I was working full time, supporting myself, and just doing my bachelor's degree. And that was the big mountain, Abby. That was the thing that I was going to do. And life would be different afterward, and I'd get a good job. And I just, that was going to be the huge lifelong accomplishment. And it took me like 6 or 7 years. And then once I was done, it was not the big thing that I thought it was. Wow. I thought I'd hit it, you know, but no. And I had some professors who were like, "You should think about grad school." And at the same, and I was like, "Grad school? I don't know anybody who went to grad school. Like who goes to grad school?" And they just kept at it in a good way that they were like, "You can do this," because I'm the kind of person who like goes to open office hours, who shows up all the time because I just wanted to do well and learn. And so they were like, "You can do this." But and it was those professors, which is kind of a common story, but it was the professors who just kept pushing me. And I'd never even considered that for my life. Yeah. And it changed my life.
That's such a cool story. And, you know, I had a professor that made a huge difference in my life, too. And I think it speaks to the idea of that one caring adult in your life. Mm-hmm. I mean, even though you're a young adult, but there's that one caring person that takes an interest, sees the potential in you, and then makes sure to know that you are capable. And I think it's huge.
It's huge.
It's huge for people. I think we need to remember that as we interact with young people and young children, to be that adult that sees in them what they don't see in themselves.
Absolutely.
So I want to continue. You have an incredible education story, and so I want to keep talking about that when we come right back.
I'm Dave Cawley, investigative journalist and host of the podcast Cold. Don't miss Cold's new season 3, where I look into the unsolved disappearance of Cherie Warren, a woman last seen leaving her job at a Salt Lake City office in 1985. Police cast suspicion on Cherie's estranged husband and boyfriend, but never made any arrests or recovered Cherie's remains. Find Cold Season 3, The Search for Cherie, anywhere you get your podcasts.
We're back here with Liz Owens. She's the CEO of YWCA Utah, and you just have an incredible story and an incredible education path. So you started out at UVU, and then you got through that, decided to go on, mm-hmm. Because you'd been encouraged by some mentors. So then what?
So I studied sociology at UVU and was really interested in society and groups of people, and I was really interested in human rights. And at that time, which was like the late 2000s, human rights was really understood globally as a set of legal instruments that started with the International Human Rights Act. And in the U.S., it was really focused on teaching in human rights. So most of the programs were Ivy League education programs, which is not what I was really interested in. And so I had to look outside of the U.S., which, again, just never even considered. And so I ended up going to the University of Essex, which is the first human rights program in the world, and studied the theory and practice of human rights, which is very legal as well, but there was a lot of theory. And I ended up staying there. Now, I moved from Provo to Essex, which is a suburb of London, mind you, and I hated it.
I was going to say, that is a transition.
It was such a culture shock. I was like, everybody's so rude here, and they know where they're going. Like, they get off the subway, they get off the tube, and they just, like, straight know where they're going, where I'm like dawdling, or if I'm walking on the street, then I say hi to someone I pass, because that's how it was in Provo.
Yeah.
You'd acknowledge a stranger, but people would avoid you. And I was like, everybody is so mean here.
They're probably really suspect of you, because they were like, who is this lady who is just, what does she want? She's so darn friendly.
I'm sure that is what it was exactly, because after living there for 5 years, I became that way, where someone would like stop me with a smile and I was like, what are you selling? Right? Like, try not to make eye contact. But yeah, I was that person from Provo, Utah, and I didn't think I'd stay. But then I had the opportunity to do an internship with a women's rights organization. Mm-hmm. It was a really cool organization that started out as a suffragist organization, and then moved into women's policy. And I worked on a campaign that looked at the intersection of race and gender and policy implications for for women of color. And that continued. It taught me that I didn't want to work in policy, first of all. But it continued to help me think more clearly and have a broader context of the way in which women experience really gender in the world and how that is influenced by all their different identities. So I began working for an organization called Women in Prison, and we worked with women affected by the criminal justice system, from teen girls to all of the girls in London and Southeast England prisons and all of the women there. And it was just like, I mean, it was one of the things in my life that has changed me the most, I think, because our prisons, their prisons, and I think ours are probably not different, but I thought of myself as different from these women, mm-hmm. and maybe thought of myself as special and unique in a way that I made better decisions or something. And then I spent a lot of time in prison with these women. And I was like, there, but for the grace of God, go I. Because once you hear someone's story, I'm like, I don't know how you could have chosen different. Like, you've been making every decision to survive. And if I imagine myself in your life story, I can't imagine ending up anywhere else either, because you were trying to make decisions to survive, and you did. And for poor women, that often meant drug use and other things. And for women of color, it often meant, some immigration issues and coming without visas and that sort of thing. So, but I could see how different women were impacted by the criminal justice system based on their different experiences and different identities. And so, what I realized is that we are all really impacted by the environment and the support and the access to support around us. And that I was really lucky. Yeah. I was really lucky to be born and raised in a place where I had a lot of support and safety and access to support. And some people don't have that, and that they have all the potential I have. And they have all of the abilities and desires and dreams, but they just can't break into that access. And sometimes, the terrible story is that sometimes folks are just in the situation as young children. And then by the time they're like, wait a second, it's like they've already made a set of decisions that have put them down pathways and tracks in life that are just so hard to overcome, because you might then be 20 with a couple of kids. And all your choices then are constrained by raising your kids well. And
And then all of a sudden your decisions become less and less. There becomes less and less choices. Yes. You can't make those choices because of the things you're. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. That's fascinating.
Yeah. So it really kind of shook my world and broadened my understanding. And I spent a lot of time reflecting on the way that I thought about my life up until that point. And that story continually shifted, because as I learned more, I'd look back at it. And I think sitting here today, I say, I love my childhood and I love being raised in Provo, and I couldn't imagine anything different. But it's also because I've learned more about the world and can hold that in context with all the things that I've learned about the world. If you would have asked me when I was 16, I probably would have been like, Provo's so lame. And right. I don't really like it. And I wish I could see the world. But I understand now how where I was raised matters. Mm-hmm. And all of the support and access around me. I'm here today because of all of the people and the environments that I've had the privilege to be a part of. And other people haven't been so lucky.
Yeah. And by nothing that we did.
Yes.
I feel the same way. I was raised in a rural community, not far from Provo. Mm-hmm. But I didn't appreciate it when I was younger. I was raised on a farm, on a ranch, and I was saying, I want to get out of here. Now it's every weekend we're trying to go home.
Yeah.
But I love your point. But for the grace of God, go I. I've thought that a lot with homelessness. And there was a point where my dad was out of work. He started a company and it had failed, and he had 10 kids and no work. And there was a moment when I was working with some of our friends experiencing homelessness. And I remember thinking, my gosh, this could have been me.
Mm-hmm.
This could have been me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's just so many ways it could be.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But
yeah.
Yeah. So talk a little bit about maybe the differences you see in, you talked about, you spent a lot of time in the prison system in the UK. Do you see some similarities? Do you see some differences here in the US? Have you spent much time? I don't know if you've done much outside of what you did there, but are there differences in those two places?
I think in terms of the criminal justice system, or at least in terms of custody and being sent to custody in England, they call it remanded in custody. But it is different, because here there is sort of this kind of social element of punishment, that it's the consequence of the decisions you made. And in England, that exists to some degree, but there's more of kind of a social and also kind of a legal precedent of the potential for rehabilitation. Mm-hmm. So their sentences aren't as long at all there, which at some point at times I'd hear of crimes that someone committed and be like, what? They only got that amount of time, right? But I do appreciate the idea that people are redeemable. Mm-hmm. And I think that I think that lacks in the structure of our criminal justice system. And then in the resettlement system, or just our practices when people are resettling, because what we know is that when they're coming out of custody, it's really hard to redeem yourself when you can't get a job because you have a record, when you can't pay rent because you have a record. Like, where else do you go but the world that you came from that led you to prison?
Right.
So I see that kind of difference, whereas when you are released in England, you actually have full access to their benefit systems. So,
oh, okay.
You can get back on your feet, and it can be a period of life where you were in custody, but you were settled in the community, you got housing, you got connected to benefits and a job, and you can kind of move on from that with the support that you need in a different area than perhaps you came from that led you there. It's really hard in the U.S. It's like the structures are just so in place to lead people, to keep people where they're at.
Mm, that's interesting. What about the drug use? And you mentioned a lot of times that's where people end. Do you feel like it feels the same? I mean, that's the same problem as we have here, is the drug use.
Definitely. Definitely. I think that it never is just the drug use, right? It just is that, but it never stands alone, and it is just so prevalent. It is like, it's folks self-medicating to some degree. There's all different reasons why I know people use drugs, but it was everywhere. And it is also everywhere here. So it's a conversation we often have at YWCA too, because what does it mean to see someone as they are and support them to accessing safety and security? And do we have hard stops where we're like, no drugs? Or do we accept that actually this is a part of the community that we're serving? So how do we connect them to the resources they need to be safe and healthy? Mm. And that's a constant balance. Between harm reduction and a hard line.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, that's so fascinating. So then you spent that time there in England, in the UK, and then what brought you back? Mm.
Well, first of all, I ended up loving it, built a community there. So even though I thought I could never live there, I think I totally like absorbed it and became the fast walker and all of those things.
I felt like I went there once. We visited once, and I thought, my first thought was like, oh, it feels a little like home, because for me, I'm looking at like, they look just like my grandparents, because mm-hmm. that's where my family came from. A lot of them was from England. And mm-hmm. so it was this like familiarity, but still very Europe.
Yeah. Yeah.
A lot of smoking, which
I
had a really hard time with.
Yeah.
But yeah.
A lot of public confrontation too, which doesn't happen in Provo.
Yeah.
Like, in the same way where it's like, I paid $2 for the, and someone's fighting with someone at a store or something. I'm like, I would never do that.
We decided Utah, our natural state, is passive aggressive.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
not aggressive aggressive.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I saw that all the time and I was like, I would never do that. So, okay. I forgot the question.
No, what brought you back?
Yeah. Oh, you know, I was in my early 30s and I was talking to friends here and they were like, oh yeah, I'm buying a house and everything. And that just wasn't happening in London. And it just seemed so far away there, because I still worked in there, they call it charities or the third sector. So I still worked with nonprofits, and I was just like, hey, and I lived in a flat with, there was like seven other people and they were all older than me. And mm-hmm. I was like, is this what I have to look forward to? And my friends there who are buying flats, they have much different kind of house buying system, because London is really old and they have different, you can buy a percentage of a flat and things like that. And that's what they were doing. And it'd be like a one bedroom flat where it's them and their husband and their kid. Mm-hmm. And I was like, this is your mortgage. Like, this is where you're going to settle down. So that was hard, because the quality of life I felt like I could have in Utah was better, and I had access to that, and that appealed to me. And then my family's here, and you know, my now husband, and we were still dating long distance, mm. and he was, we were trying to see if he could move there, but I was like, everything is there in Utah. Yeah. So yeah, I came back.
Oh, I love that you're back. And now I want to get into your work at the YWCA, all the amazing things that are going on there. And we'll do that when we come right back. And we are here having a conversation with Liz Owens. We've had such a great conversation. And I really want to get into, you know, where we met. Again, we did this project together. You were so gracious. And again, it was kind of COVID central in the middle of everything. And I said, hey, do you want to plan, help me plan this project? What have you got for us? And it was so cool.
It's so cool.
It was seriously, it was so fun. We had the spouses of the legislature, the legislative spouses were there with us. We painted two murals in some of the public spaces there at the YWCA campus. Mm-hmm. And it was just a moment, I think, for all of us. Again, we were not really doing things in big groups, and it was still really kind of a scary time for a lot of folks. And it was just kind of this connecting moment. Mm-hmm. And so I learned a little bit about what the YWCA does and is. And I would love for you to talk a little bit about your work. Again, you came in right during COVID, so it was a crazy time. But let's talk a little bit about what you're doing there, what it is, who you're helping, all those kinds of things.
So YWCA is a part of a global organization, actually, that sort of sprung up as a counterpart to YMCA. So it started as the Young Women's Christian Association, but now we are non-denominational. We're a secular organization, but that's how it started. And the organization's about 130 years old in the U.S. And as across the U.S., YWCA USA has about 200, I think, and 20 associations. And those associations started out providing meeting places for women in the community. It actually started out as a place where women who were moving from more rural community into urban centers needed a safe place to stay and live. And so that's why YWCA was originally created. And then it just continued to shift to meet the needs of the communities in which they're at. And so 116 years ago, YWCA Utah was started. And it also started as a boarding home for women who were working in the city, but who came from our rural communities. And it shifted over the years. It's been a halfway house. It's provided places for, like during World War II, where women would go and get some job training. And then after World War II, get more sort of training and support and classrooms, workshops around housekeeping and cooking and kind of returning to the home from being in the workforce as a lot of the soldiers came home and then took up the jobs that women had during the war. And so and our YWCA did all of that as well. We were the first boarding home, first job force for women in Utah. And we just continued to change over the years. And in 1970, YWCA USA decided to add to the mission. It's always been women focused, but decided to add some element of anti-racism or racial equity work to it. And I think coming from out of the 60s and thinking about women who really needed spaces to gather and lacked access to a lot of opportunities, YWCAs across the country had been providing spaces. So they were a place that was already providing some spaces for that allowed Black women to gather, although it wasn't necessarily integrated, but they would have a day or a space and a time and that sort of thing. So in Utah, we have a pool that is no longer in use. It's a little over 100 years old. And we have the gym, of which was one of the places you did the mural. And I have to tell you, Abby, the Jazz are redoing that gym for our kids. And they're doing it with their new theme.
Is my mural going away?
But we were like, listen, no way. We were like, you can touch anything but our mural. And so, no, it's not. But it is going to be matched with the Jazz colors. And we were just like, you just can't touch this wall. And they're touching everything else. New floors, other walls.
Cool.
And so it would be.
I was going to say, if it were to be anything, if I had to give up the mural to the Jazz,
We didn't want that. We loved it, though, because that mural made a difference day by day walking through that gym or having the kids play. It was just, it's so happy and colorful. We actually wanted them to design it, the rest of the gym around the mural. But but also really happy they're designing it around the jazz. So
love it.
Yeah, yeah. So in 1976, YWCA's decided to create women's shelters. Battered women's shelters is what they called them back then. And today, YWCA USA as an association is the largest provider of domestic violence shelters for women. Okay. And in Utah, we were the first and are the largest provider in the state of emergency shelter for women and children. And that opened in 1976 and remains open. We have a child care center that opened in 1966 for our community and remains open. And we also have children's services that serve after school and also a drop-in kind of crisis nursery for residents. And then we have a transitional affordable housing complex. So we actually have six buildings in central Salt Lake City, and we provide the walk-in services, emergency shelter for women and children and men. We provide housing for some folks and all of the children's services. And then our child care early education center serves some of the people on our campus, but mostly the community because there's 100 spots for kids to come in. And of course, we can't fulfill that all. So, and which has been really needed during the pandemic. And we feel really grateful, not only that we were able to weather and stay open, because that was really hard for child care centers.
So you were open and were you still running your early childhood programs the whole time?
Early childhood stayed open, which was hard, I think, mainly because of obviously the exposure as well as the great resignation, and the pay for teachers is just really low. And we experienced that. And of course, our emergency shelter and our walk-in services, 100% of our services remained operational because we have a commitment to the community. Yeah. And in times of need, the need's still there. So,
in fact, it probably increased.
Right. It did. Right? It did. And so from our, you know, entry level staff to me, everybody just had a commitment to show up, and we were scared at times, and just there was so much changing information. It was a whole new world about your own risk, and we all have people at home or ourselves who might be vulnerable. But we really focused on the organization practices a trauma informed model, and we're certified in what's called Sanctuary. And that really became our recipe and our guide for how we treat each other, how we take care of ourselves, how we support our residents in crisis. And I feel really grateful that the organization did that. They were certified in February of 2020, right before I came, because the mental health toll on staff, on residents, on all of us just increased. There was so much uncertainty, and every day we're dealing with crises and a lot of heartbreaking stories around the children and the women we're serving. And a lot of great stories too, but holding all of that for what's happening in the world and what's happening on our campus, just felt like a lot. And being able to call upon all of our sanctuary tools and thinking about how we engage with each other with kindness and compassion, and that we really just focused on, we will get through this, and we knew we would as a society and as an organization. And the thing we're going to remember is how we treated each other and how we took care of ourselves. And so we were like, no matter what, let's be kind to each other, because that's all we're going to remember. We're going to talk about a pandemic happened, and we don't want to remember that we were all stressed out. That might be part of the story, but I think that the narrative will be different because we continue to think about how we take care of each other and how we just lead with kindness and compassion. And that's trauma informed. And we're trying to do that for ourselves while we try to provide that space for the children and the women who live with us.
Oh gosh, that's incredible. I love the thought of leading with kindness, leading with compassion. You mentioned a couple of times trauma-informed, and maybe just explain a little bit about what that means. We did some trauma-informed training for our show-up board, and we're really pushing this idea, because we've been working with foster children and foster families, and this idea of trauma-informed training. I've not heard it called Sanctuary. I don't know that program, but we know about trauma-informed. Talk a little bit more about what that means, and just I just think every human probably should be trauma informed at this point.
Definitely. Well, trauma informed as a theory and a practice really means that you understand as a person that everybody has experienced some form of harm or hurt or trauma, and that really informs how you engage with them. So one of the ways we talk about it in domestic violence and is instead of asking what's wrong with you, we ask what's happened to you. And an example of that is if you have a woman or a child who is behaving in some kind of way, right? Like maybe they're in their room and they're yelling and they're screaming and they're running around and they seem really erratic. And as an advocate and someone who's supporting them, and you could say, well, what's wrong with you, right? Mm-hmm. Or you could say, what's happened to you? And when you say what's happened to you, there's a shift in your own mind of the situation and how you engage, because you understand that this person has been through something and that the way that they're responding could be a very natural response. And then you understand that for yourself and for everybody around you. So, for example, if there is a staff member who comes in late all the time, right, who is not getting their work done, who is always off camera in the virtual meetings, I could call them in and say, what's wrong with you? Or I could say, tell me what's happening. What's happening to you? What's happening with you? And that shifts my own mind of the situation. And it leaves me open to here's that word again, being curious about their experience. And if I'm curious about their experience, then I'm engaging in an open way. And I hope with an open heart and open mind. So really the heart of trauma-informed approach is understanding that, you know, that people have gone through something and being really open to understanding that the way that they're reacting might actually be really reasonable. I think of it because I actually live in Lehigh, so I'm in rush hour every day. And I always think about it when someone's driving erratically, like maybe they need their meds, maybe they have someone who's sick in the car. Like I just want to take a trauma-informed approach, because then I'm not like mad at them. I'm not shaking my fist. I'm like, yep, you're in a hurry. And you could be in a hurry because you got to get home, your wife's in labor, whatever. Like for all of these reasons, so many things could be happening to you. Mm-hmm. And if I choose to assume the best and give them the benefit of the doubt while understanding, yeah, people are always going through things, then I engage differently. And then the engagement is, the relationship is different. The collaboration is different. And we hope that it creates a safer space for everybody, for staff and for residents, and for our organization as a whole. Often in kind of crisis work, there are crises every day, and some of them are heartbreaking, and that reverberates through the organization. And taking a trauma-informed approach is one way that we hope calms that really stops that cycle of cycling up into an organization in trauma and in crisis, that we're an organization who's helping people heal as they experience harm. Yeah. And that means ourselves as well. But as we know from ACEs, which are adverse childhood experiences, that we carry the harm. And I think a trauma-informed approach says, how can we start to heal the harm as we go instead of carrying it until we're adults and in some sort of situation and then having to go back through childhood? And we think about that at YWCA for the kids on our campus. Like, how do we start healing now? And for the adults and for the staff, like, how do we engage with each other, solve our issues now, interrupt cycles that aren't working for us or chaotic cycles, so that we heal as we go instead of just adding trauma.
Yeah. Wow. That's powerful stuff and really important. And it's something we're trying to learn, and I'm trying to learn every day. I love the idea of just being even the person that's driving you crazy in traffic, like having that openness to having grace for somebody that may be doing something for a reason.
Yeah.
You talked a little bit about taking care of yourselves and the people that are doing this work, taking care of themselves. We've heard a lot the phrase compassion fatigue.
Mm-hmm.
How do we, I think we're all, I mean, we're seeing the trauma playing out in Ukraine. We're seeing trauma played out all over the world and even in our own communities. And again, as individuals, if there's, you know, domestic issues or things that are going on in everybody's life. And then you're daily working in this trauma sort of chaotic environment, how do you keep from getting compassion fatigue, as they say?
That's a great question. So what I believe is that compassion fatigue and burnout happens when you don't have support in your life and in your family. I actually think people can work really hard for long periods of time, and I think compassion is pretty never ending. But it's only never ending when you're filling up your cup, right? Yeah. So you have it to give. And so I think the fatigue comes when you're giving, 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 and not being able to refill the things that you need to continue to give, whether it's reading something and having strong emotions about what's happening in the world, or it is working in your community or at work and you're having strong emotions about what people are going through. You have to have a support system in your life and in your workplace that helps you navigate that so that you can continue to give. And so I think burnout, compassion fatigue are actually a result of a lack of support. And when I see that happening, I'm like, oh, here's the red flag. You need some, we need to talk about like what we can do to refill your cup, to give you space and time to breathe. Because all of the things in the world are important. All the things we do here are important. And they will always be here. And so how do we sustain ourselves so that we can continue to care and give? And the problem, I think, really shows up when you give and give and give. And then soon it's the work is taking more than you wanted to give. Mm-hmm. So it has to give back. And it's an organization's job. And it's your job as a human to build, figure out how to be that support for other people and build that support. Ask for help around yourself so that you can continue to give what you know you can give. Mm-hmm. And I think the other thing I'd say about that is because oftentimes when we care about one thing, it's all integrated. You can't care about homelessness without caring about families and people and food insecurity. But what I try to think about is I have a set of skills and an opportunity in this world to focus on one piece of the pie. And what I depend on is you to focus on your piece of the pie. Mm-hmm. And there's so many different ways to do that. You don't have to work in nonprofits. You don't have to donate money. You might have time or talent or whatever. There are so many different ways to do that. But I think if we all are working toward the benefit of our community and we think outside ourselves, I want us all to think that we're all in this community together. Yeah. We're all in this. We have to share this space. We will succeed together. And I think if you think about wherever you're at in your life, whatever your life looks like, there's probably something you can do to contribute to that. Mm. And for me, I'm like, this is the set of skills I have, and I'm gonna focus it right here, and I'm gonna depend on other folks to take care of air quality.
Yeah.
And those things that I still care about, but I have limited time and also deserve to go home and play with my toddler and just be present with them.
Yeah. So. Oh, that is such great advice. And you know, I've been talking to my kids and they get upset about issues. And I'm always, you know, like, well, I'm trying to do what I can. And I don't know how to take care of all that other stuff. But I love that thought of just really focusing on what you can do and kind of relying on other people to do the other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
I love that. This has been such a great conversation, Liz. This could go on and on forever because I'm just enthralled with your experiences and your wisdom. Let me just ask you as we end. I've heard this over and over, this idea of mentorship, and we're trying to figure out at Show Up, like, we're really trying to nail this one down, and mm-hmm. I don't think we've figured it out yet, but. Tell me somebody who has really influenced you, has been a mentor to you, and what that experience is like and the lessons that you've learned as you've tried to mentor.
It's a great question. And at some point I decided there was a time when I worked in London where I was looking for a professional mentor, and I was looking for someone who was similar to me, who could understand my experiences and the way that I navigate the world and who kind of had a similar journey. And there was no one like that because everyone's journey is unique and everyone's perspective on the world is a little unique. And then I decided to make mentors wherever I could. And that was really life-changing for me. So I have so many mentors. And I ask for help a lot. And it's surprising because so many people want to help and will like really show up for me in a lot of different ways. I have men, I have bosses, I have people who are nothing like me, and have a different life experience that I continue to learn from. And I still have so many of those people in my life who I'll call up and spend an hour with or meet for coffee. And so I end up being that funny person where I'm like, oh, I'm having lunch with this 90-year-old man because I have a lot of that in my schedule, or like this woman who retired who is like nothing like my own life experience, from, you know, corporate world or whatever, because I've just, everybody has so much good stuff to give. Mm-hmm. And, so I just decided to get it from everywhere. So that for me, and that's still my practice. Mm-hmm. I like seek mentors out in lots of different people, and not just people who have seniority to me, but there's so much I admire about my staff. Mm-hmm. And even if it's interns or whatever, and I also ask to learn from them often and ask them to lead something or teach me something. So I look for it everywhere. I don't know the answer to the mentor question because I do know that it is an important question. And it, like I said, it made all the difference in my life. It changed the trajectory of my life, having those professors who are like, well, I'll help you write the application. You need to do this. Did you call these people yet? You know, like that was really important. And I don't know how that happened besides me kind of showing up and asking for help. But even today, it's old bosses, it's new people, new friends. It's people who I have nothing on the face of it in common with. Mm. And I feel incredibly grateful for all of the love. Like that feels like love and support. And I feel like I have every resource I need to be successful, both personally and as an organization. And sometimes I don't know why I'm so lucky. So I just try to practice gratitude because I feel like there's so many people here who are willing to give you a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I don't know if that's helpful,
no,
Abby.
No, I think it's very helpful. And it takes a real sense of humility to, again, be curious and to learn from people that maybe you don't, you know, it takes a meekness as well to say, like, I'm willing to learn from somebody that has a completely different life experience from me, younger, older, whatever, you know, from different generations or different life experiences. So I think that's absolutely beautiful. So thank you. Liz, this has just been delightful and wonderful and a real learning experience for me. So thank you so much for coming on and sharing your story with us today.
Yeah. Thank you, Abby. I think that you're, I'm just so proud that you're our first lady. And I think you're, you're like an awesome, accessible, really like on the ground person. And I've seen that over the past couple of years. And I just, again, I'm so proud and always really happy to be able to talk about you and talk about who our First Lady is. So thank you.
Thank you, Liz. Yeah. Thanks again for being here. If you want to get involved with Liz Owens and her work at YWCA, visit ywcautah.org. Thanks for being a friend.